Israeli regime strikes various locations in Gaza, including the southern city of Rafah and central city of Gaza, a city leaving nearly 20 Palestinians dead. Hamas says Israel's ongoing attacks on Al-Shifa Hospital are all part of the regime's systematic destruction of Gaza's health facilities. And Israeli forces conduct new raids across the occupied West Bank as part of their crackdown against Palestinians in occupied territories. And now, nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, regime's relentless bombardment and shelling continue to claim more Palestinian lives. Latest airstrikes hit Gaza City, leaving at least 10 Palestinians dead. And earlier, a home was struck in the southern city of Rafah, where 8 people, mostly women and children, lost their lives. And 3 more people were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunis, also to the south. Israeli regime began its campaign of genocide on Gaza back on October the 7th, and since then, almost 32,000 people have been killed in the Palestinian territory, mostly women and children, and over 7,000 people are still unaccounted for and presumed buried under rubble, along with 74,000 Palestinians have so far been injured. Moti Abu Musabe, our correspondent in the city of Deir al-Bahr, joined us for the latest in the situation in the besieged territory.
The Israeli coalition forces continued their air strikes and attacks against several areas of Gaza Strip. The last night was a bloody night for the Palestinian civilians in Rafah City, whereas 8 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed and massacred after the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in Al-Brazil neighborhood located in the eastern part of the city, knowing that Rafah is still absorbing and accepting at least 1.4 million Palestinian civilians living in dire conditions there. In the meantime, those airstrikes actually were resumed here in the central area of Gaza Strip as another residential building was destroyed in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here in Deir el-Balah City. At least 10 Palestinian civilians were reportedly injured over that attack. Even the shrapnel were landed here in the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. And when it comes to Gaza City, as you know, that the current situation is still catastrophic by all means, as the Israeli brutal aggression is still maintained and continued against the Al-Shifa Square. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed and pummeled by the constant Israeli airstrikes. And in the meantime, the Israeli tanks are still firing and shelling the residential apartments and the residential buildings there. The entire area, the Al-Shifa Square, has been reduced to be an unlivable place. It has turned to a battlefield over the constant and the chronic Israeli attacks and airstrikes. It's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces for the fifth consecutive day are still attacking the Shifa complex. Needless to mention that thousands of the Palestinian civilians are still stranded inside the complex.
It's day 5 now of the Israeli regime's siege on Al-Shifa Medical Complex, where over 30,000 Palestinians are taking shelter, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The Palestinian officials say over a dozen patients have already died after they were deprived of medicine. It's because Israeli forces have cut off water and electricity to the hospital. Now Al-Shifa is the largest medical complex in Gaza. They've also abducted dozens of nurses, doctors, and hospital staff. Regime says siege will continue for several days and has ordered evacuation of patients, displaced civilians, and medical personnel. It claims Hamas fighters are inside the hospital and has already arrested over 300 of them. The Palestinian resistance movement has vehemently dismissed this. It says the attack on Al-Shifa is all part of systematic destruction of Gaza's health facilities. Hamas has also condemned what it called shameful silence of the international community to stop Israel's war. Earlier we spoke to Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster, and journalist out of St. Petersburg about Israel's repeated attacks on major health facilities in Gaza, including Al-Shifa. Now, she believes Israel feels free to deliberately attack civilians in the wake of inaction by the international community to end Israel's genocide in Gaza.
I've seen so many videos of the latest raid in Al-Shifa, and while they claim that there were terrorists, all I heard is guns from the Israeli side, but no one was shooting back, which shows that there are no resistance fighters, terrorists, or whatever Israel claims in that hospital, and there are mostly civilians. It is clear that they're not targeting military targets. They are targeting only civilian targets, and the overwhelming deaths are civilian, and the injuries are overwhelmingly civilian. So while they continue to use that justification, overwhelming video evidence, eyewitness evidence shows that they are basically targeting the population of Gaza as a whole. Because they have not taken any action and they continue to ship more and more arms to Israel, it is a tacit endorsement of Israel's tactics. There are no red lines. There is nothing that Israel can do to cause these Western countries to stop supporting Israel. And that's the main message, besides some lip service that they are willing to give some of the time in some bodies.
The Israeli regime's forces have carried out new raids on various areas throughout the occupied West Bank, including in Tubas. They also clashed with Palestinian resistance fighters defending the areas and made some arrests. We were earlier joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candil, for your details.
As every day we wake up to know that the Israeli forces had raided several areas across the occupied West Bank. We are not speaking about the specific areas, whether in the north or in the south or central, the occupied West Bank. Unfortunately, Israeli forces continue to storm villages, towns, and cities all across the occupied West Bank. What happened late on Thursday and early on Friday is that the Israeli forces had stormed the city of Tubas as well as Qalqilia. And in Al-Khalil, a number of villages the Israeli forces had stormed, like the village of Karmel, as well as Tuwani. And in Jenin, the Israelis had been storming the areas of Jenin, despite the fact that the Israeli military continued to carry out airstrikes against Palestinians there. And as experts are saying, it's even more easy for them to assassinate and kill those Palestinian fighters that the Israelis describe as wanted by the Israeli military. The Israelis stormed the village of Barta'a in Jenin, as well as Arabi and other areas like Fahmi, Kfar Ra'i, Umdar, and Ya'bad. So we are speaking about almost the majority of the villages to the south of Jenin had been stormed by the Israeli forces. And of course, the Israeli soldiers had arrested a number of Palestinians all across the occupied West Bank. A recent report by the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, the Israeli forces had detained 7,700 Palestinians since the 7th of October, including, of course, children and women. And a number of Palestinians who had been released recently by the Israeli forces in the latest swap deal between the resistance group and Israel, those had been again detained by the Israeli forces, including women.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has been pushing forward with its anti-Israel operations amid the regime's unrelenting onslaught on Gaza. However, a recently launched foreign-backed propaganda campaign is seeking to undermine widespread support for Hezbollah's endeavors. Miriam Sadler reports.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war." If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon. Certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people. And especially in that it is, and we have informations, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorshi Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though it is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its supportive military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Nowruz and traditional rituals are being celebrated also in Italy. The Iranian embassy has organized a gathering in Rome to mark the Persian New Year.
On Thursday, the celebration of Nowruz and arrival of the Persian year of 1403 was held at the Rome residence of the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Italy, a well-laid aft-scene table bearing seven auspicious items starting with the letter S was put out as the guests, mostly Iranian expats and Italians, were welcoming the first day of the new year and the arrival of spring.
Nowruz is much more than a tradition, it is a culture. Nowruz symbolizes the victory of good over evil, the balance of the spring. Nowruz means to lay all grievances aside and to celebrate family ties and friendship. Nowruz is a time for peace and reconciliation. It is a time for cleaning our homes.
The embassy's Nowruz celebration ceremony included a feast of Iranian food, followed by vibrant traditional music. Millions of people across the world celebrate Nowruz and its traditional rituals that emphasize the values of peace, solidarity, and goodwill towards all. 25,000 Iranians currently residing in Italy are among those who celebrate the Persian New Year.
I'm from Tehran. I've been living in Italy for 40 years. Even though we are far away from our homeland, we were all waiting for the Nowruz celebrations. It's really important for us because that's where our roots lie.
Io sono Gaudia, sono italiana.
My name is Gaudia and I'm Italian. I've been married to an Iranian man for 49 years. The Nowruz tradition has become a part of my life. I love celebrating nature and renewal in nature, and I'm proud that I'm passing on this wonderful tradition to my grandchildren.
People at the gathering share the same belief that it is important to embrace Nowruz's universal message of renewal and unity, and that its celebration is also an opportunity to reflect on the past year, nurture new hopes, and celebrate the continuous cycle of life. Max Civili, Rome.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Hazrat Khadija's value has not been properly appreciated. This is the part of the speech delivered on May 9, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with officials of the Hazrat Khadija Commemoration Congress. It is said about Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, God's greetings be upon him, that he gave up his entire possessions or half of his belongings several times over his lifetime. This is among the greatest privileges. Hazrat Khadija has the privilege of giving up her entire wealth by dedicating it in the way of promoting Islam and strengthening the Holy Prophet. After that too, she endured many hardships and sufferings, one of which was her 3 years of sufferings in the valley of Abi Talib. There, she endured great sufferings and preserved her strong faith. The Holy Quran says about those people who do charitable work before and after a victory, not equal among you are those who spent freely and fought before the victory with those who did so later. Holy Quran, chapter 57, verse 10. Before the victory means before conquering Mecca. It means that she had donated her money before the Holy Prophet had Medina at his disposal and before he held power and established a government, and while he needed it most.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
She dedicated her wealth, her life, and her comfort. Well, these are important virtues which have been forgotten. Therefore, she is really unrecognized. She is really oppressed. Mr. Arafi described her as lonely. This is really the case. Hazrat Khadija, greetings be upon her, is really lonely. You mentioned that she was the mother of 11 imams, but she was actually the mother of 12 imams. This is because she is considered the mother of the commander of the faithful as well. She raised the commander of the faithful under her care and supervision to a certain age. In any case, this is a very good and important endeavor, and by Allah's favor, it will yield many blessings. Anyway, we thank Mr. Arafi, Mr. Rafi, and the other gentlemen who are cooperating on this matter, and I hope that they will receive their rewards from the Holy Prophet, God willing. This endeavor will surely have the approval of God's Messenger. God's greetings be upon him and his household. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello and welcome to our program. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. Today, we go face-to-face with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mr. Mohammad Islami, as we talk about the different fields where Iran has made significant advancements in when it comes to nuclear science and technology, and also talk about some of the double standards that the UN nuclear watchdog has been using when it comes to its attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran and see where it originates from. So stay tuned. Mr. Mohammad Islami, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
We are as well. So let's first talk about the document for the 20-year nuclear technology vision that we have. Can you tell me about what goals are set in that document?
Indeed, in the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Every organization naturally needs a vision, a defined plan within a specific time frame, outlining goals, policies, and strategies based on studies of actual conditions, aligning the organization's movement with those very directions. By divine grace, we managed to formulate the document for the 20-year vision of nuclear technology, with the participation of all relevant parties, leading to the recognition of the industry's potential impact on all dimensions of people's lives and the modern economy. This was well received by all relevant bodies within the Islamic Republic of Iran's administration and establishment, and we were able to have the document unveiled by the president after going through all the stages of approval. In the middle of the last Persian calendar year, when this document was unveiled, the entire organization's movement was aligned with the path laid by the document. We are currently progressing along this path with five primary goals in mind. Firstly, the process of nuclear fuel supply and necessary activities within the industrial chain and testing in the fuel process. Our aim is to complete and reach the capacity necessary to cover the required objectives outlined in the document. This was an effective step, indicating our utilization of diverse resources, allowing our fuel cycle to become a comprehensive, sustainable industry capable of expansion. We are progressing in this direction. The second pillar was clean and sustainable energy. Climate change is a serious global concern, with a net zero carbon emission target set for 2050. Naturally, our country, being highly vulnerable to climate change, has strongly emphasized the goal of producing clean and sustainable energy. We have included the objective of generating 20,000 megawatts of new nuclear power in this vision document, requiring comprehensive scientific and industrial research efforts to achieve this goal. The third pillar observed in this process was the development of the nuclear industry in the medical and health sector. In the medical and health domain, we target expanding the capacity for producing radiopharmaceuticals in order to become a global player and a consistent innovator at the forefront. We aim to benefit from the nuclear industry in producing radioisotopes, radiopharmaceuticals, especially novel radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals, and this too is a focal point of the industry. The fourth focus is the development of irradiation applications and protection against contamination. In a real sense, two extensive steps are dedicated to ensuring food security and community health. We utilize irradiation to sterilize agricultural products. In our country, which annually produces around 130 million tons of agricultural goods, this process helps eliminate toxins and pests and extends their shelf life. This, in turn, contributes to national economic prosperity, supports businesses in this domain, and boosts household economies. Additionally, protection against radiation contamination is crucial. Accordingly, the Safety Protection Center is slated to evolve into a more efficient state institution, capable of appropriately fulfilling its legal duty of radiation protection. The fifth pillar of the vision document concerns human resources. We require effective human resources. Our approach to industrial research and development involves considering the development of human resources and scientific advancement. This pillar includes R&D projects at the forefront of knowledge aimed at practical flourishing, technological attainment, streamlining the innovation cycle from idea to product, and simultaneously ensuring the necessary workforce for the present and future of the organization. These were the five fundamental chapters observed in the vision document.
Right, so let's go over each of these points one by one. So the first one was the procurement of the nuclear fuel for the reactors. Let's talk about the process of getting there. So from the excavation of uranium-235 to the utilization of uranium-235. How much of this process is domesticized, and where are we in reaching that goal we have in the 20-year vision?
Clearly, we're one of the countries significantly affected by unjust double standards. Due to nuclear sanctions, there has been no cooperation provided to us in our nuclear sector. Hence, all our processes in research are directed toward anticipated results, utilizing our research capabilities specifically tailored to yield technological products, especially nuclear fuel. Today, we possess a sustainable capacity for our required fuel, aiming to independently design, construct, and operate power plants, needing critical fuel, and ultimately operating them with Iranian-made fuel.
So let's go over the second point that you mentioned with regards to the goals of the IAEA. According to the recent remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he said that reaching that 20,000 megawatts of power generated through these nuclear power plants is crucial for the 20-year vision. Where are we along the path of reaching that 20,000 megawatts?
We've designed an operation plan for this 20,000 megawatts. Based on studies conducted in Iran by Westerners over the past 50 years for establishing nuclear power plants, which we updated, we identified regions and established companies for achieving the 20,000 megawatt target by setting up and operating nuclear power generation plants. These companies primarily function along the southern coasts, with one also situated in the northern coastal area, conducting in-depth environmental and geological studies. One of these companies, ahead in its environmental geological data, has progressed to the stage of ordering equipment and initiating operational activities at its site. Therefore, every 20,000 megawatt capacity has been divided into five different regions, each of them in a different phase of operation within the program, and each is in motion.
The third point was the usage of nuclear science and technology in the medical field. So there are, of course, different areas where you can tackle medical sciences using nuclear sciences. For example, let's talk about using plasma therapy and where we are in the world when it comes to our position, when it comes to plasma therapy, and what kind of cancers or different types of illnesses are we targeting with it.
Currently, in the field of radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals, we have reached operational capacity with about 50 radiopharmaceuticals used in diagnostic, palliative, and therapeutic areas. Approximately 1 million individuals in the country benefit from these medical services and radiopharmaceuticals annually. Importantly, we're expanding our capacity in this realm, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively, we aim for higher precision in diagnostic radioisotopes to aid medical professionals in better diagnosis. And quantitatively, we're striving to enhance their effectiveness, especially for therapeutic radiopharmaceuticals. Currently, we have 13 new radiopharmaceuticals undergoing critical trials, progressing along this path. Parallel to the discussion on radiopharmaceuticals is plasma therapy. We've dedicated efforts to plasma therapy over the past 2 years. Currently, the clinical trial phase involves using plasma for treating non-healing wounds, particularly in diabetic patients. Another clinical phase is plasma therapy for cancer treatment, currently being used in operating rooms. We're expanding plasma therapy utilization for its significant potential in combating cancer, and we're actively pursuing this goal.
Now, before I touch on the fourth point, one of the goals of the IAEA has been to implement the usage of smaller scale reactors. I want to know about the reason behind that and how far along we are in implementing and reaching that goal that we want to.
Look, the objective outlined by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the Global Pursuit, particularly in the recent COP28 summit in Abu Dhabi, where countries pledged to triple their nuclear power capacities, aims at carbon emission reduction. Carbon emission reduction is attainable through increased nuclear power plant capacity. However, not all countries or locations can accommodate large-scale nuclear plants. Hence, research into miniature technology has been underway. This aims to design and build small-scale, widely distributed nuclear power plants in various countries, facilitating the pursuit of the 2050 net-zero carbon emission goal. Because nuclear power plants' efficiency is often over 93% to 95%, unlike other power plants with significantly lower efficiency, the stability and cleanliness of this energy emphasizes accelerating this IAEA-defined goal through scientific and engineering endeavors.
Now, the fourth goal that you mentioned for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was the usage of irradiation and the tools that we use to protect the operators from irradiation when they're working in, like, for example, reactors and the radioisotope making. So can you tell us about some of the different tools that we have been able to make? For example, there are the measurement tools, the precision tools that we have made, and also the contamination monitors, and also some of the usages of the irradiation, different irradiation devices that we have made.
There were two important aspects in your question that I want to address. Firstly, in the field of radioisotopes, one rapidly expanding aspect globally is the nuclear measurement system, nuclear instrumentation used in advanced industries. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has introduced these systems, and today we have complete mastery of advanced versions of these nuclear instrumentation systems and design, and we produce and provide support for them for various industries in the country. This is one aspect. The second aspect regarding irradiation exposure involves our radiation-generating systems. We have designed cyclotrons and gamma irradiation systems, both pool-type and self-shielded types. We've incorporated these into our agenda to design these systems, procure the required irradiation sources, and through studies conducted for the country's needs, implement these across all production centers, be it industrial or agricultural products, suitable for irradiation. Over a 3-year plan, God willing, we'll establish these to enable products to undergo radiation exposure, creating high added value financially and economically. Most importantly, this contributes to food security and public health. irradiation not only increases productivity and efficiency, but also enhances safety and health for the people. Another critical point is our capability to provide various educational accelerators and research tools, similar to those in nuclear power plants. You'll find similar simulations, just like the one behind us, in the control rooms of Bushehr nuclear power plant. These simulations serve educational purposes in universities and even in power plants for operational training. These systems, in line with research and human resource development in the fifth pillar that I mentioned, are designed, built, and made available to target centers.
Now, in the process of making all these radioisotopes or these precision tools, the density measurement tools and whatnot, and making of these radiopharmaceuticals, one crucial point, especially when it comes to the reactors and where the radioisotopes are made, is the usage of heavy water and light water. So we consume and produce a lot of both of these two types of waters, and I would assume there's a level of exporting that we do for these light and heavy waters. So what is our place globally when it comes to the exports and the demand that there is for our light and heavy water?
This is a very important issue. Our organization is a key player globally as a producer of heavy water, holding a sustainable share in the international market. Our capacity stands out significantly compared to our competitors due to its quality. What's important for us is not just the heavy water used in reactors, but also its derivatives, approximately 230 types, which find utility across various industries, particularly in pharmaceuticals, especially medications based on deuterium. We're following this path and are thankful that through the efforts of our young scientists and researchers, we have achieved this global standard. We're currently expanding and enhancing the capabilities and the efficiency of these products.
So we're right now at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and perhaps the most important parts of this whole facility, this whole area, is the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center. What is the goal, the main goal of this Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center?
Relentless movement towards progress serves as the goal of our research sector. This allows us to stay on the path at the forefront of knowledge, utilize our findings through articles and commercialization of technologies to serve humanity, and expand them. Our distinction from advanced countries when it comes to new sciences and technologies lies in our dedication to serving humanity and sustainability of peace. We don't impose control, but engage with all countries with the aim of making these technologies available to them. Therefore, our research direction aims to remain at the forefront of knowledge and relentlessly pursue new findings.
So a major part of the research side of things happens right here. But how does this research and the results that come out of it get implemented into industries? What does the path look like, and where do knowledge-based companies play a part along this path?
The knowledge-based companies born out of this research stream are technological developers. We undertake the risks associated with these new technologies initially to the extent where risks are minimized, enabling other companies and industries to utilize them. The research flow and the technology development stream in the Atomic Energy Organization is being handled within a knowledge-based network. We have introduced open project policies and innovation, intending to utilize all capacities in the process of transforming knowledge into technology and industry. Our perspective is international, and that's why next year, on the 50th anniversary of the Atomic Energy Organization's establishment, we're organizing the first international nuclear conference in Iran, welcoming various countries and the agency. Our inaugural conference carries the message of peaceful nuclear technology for everyone and nuclear weapons for no one. In this regard, we're pleased that through an international initiative next year, we'll be the initiators of an active movement to promote nuclear sciences and technologies globally.
Now let's get a more in-depth look at one of these nuclear power plants and see what it is actually capable of. So for instance, the Bushehr nuclear power plant. What is the capacity of its power production, and what can we expect from it in the future?
Power plant number one in Bushehr is a facility with a nominal capacity of 1,025 megawatts. This power plant, in the year of 2023, has completed its 10th year of operation. To date, it has injected over 62 billion kilowatt hours of electricity into our national grid, preventing the emission of over 90 million cubic meters of greenhouse gases and saving approximately 90 million barrels of oil. This demonstrates Iran's commitment to clean energy. We're addressing a lag in the construction of power plants by expediting the implementation of units 2 and 3 in the Bushehr power plant, currently under construction. Our endeavor in executing the 20,000 megawatt plan is to showcase ourselves as prominent players in the global field of atomic power plant design and construction. It's a response to the political turmoil and psychological security measures that have been fabricated against Iran's nuclear program, which are entirely false and baseless. We operate transparently and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, extending our nuclear activities for peace and security.
So the Bushehr facility is a nuclear power plant. Over here, in this facility, we have a research reactor. What are the other research reactors or power plants that we can expect in the future to be made?
We currently have two research reactors that are being designed and constructed. One is a 20-megawatt research reactor, and the other is a 10-megawatt research reactor. Additionally, we have a zero-power research reactor intended for educational and research purposes in the design and construction phase. These three projects constitute our research backbone, supporting our national education and the production of various radioisotopes required in the medical and industrial sectors.
So the next subject would be nuclear fusion technology. It's, to my understanding, the next step for us. So where are we along the path of reaching the technology to be able to use nuclear fusion and the power that we get from that?
This is a very important point. Nuclear fusion is the future, particularly when it comes to achieving clean, sustainable energy. And it is being pursued collectively and individually by nations. In our country, within the Atomic Energy Organization, one of our key and fundamental projects is the Nuclear Fusion Project. Utilizing all scientific and research elements that can assist the organization and participate in the projects, we have initiated these plans with the goal of creating a tokamak with a designated scale. Hopefully, we can present our research findings.
So why even is it the future step? Why is nuclear fusion technology more difficult to achieve? And how do you compare the power or the usage that we get out of nuclear fusion compared to the nuclear fission reactors that we already have?
It's evident that this path is both challenging and costly, involving time-consuming and expansive research efforts. All nations involving in this matter are working towards maintaining sustainable energy. No one casts an economic view on this matter. Everyone is working on it with a scientific and research-oriented approach. What matters is the existence of this activity, regardless of the scale or duration of the energy derived from nuclear fusion. The importance lies in mastering the processes, elements, and components to transform it into a system, be it projects carried out worldwide or aligned with the focus observed in France. We are continuing our efforts independently, aligning with those pursuits.
So let's stay on the topic of these international governing bodies, namely the IAEA. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has said in a recent report that Iran has increased its production of highly enriched uranium, to which you responded that there has been no change in our capacity for production. Do you think that the IAEA may be playing into the hands of the Zionist entity and their propaganda machine?
This is quite clear. Even in the instance where the Director General speaks and warns the world, saying, don't forget about Iran while your attention is on Gaza, it fuels Iranophobia, contrary to international norms and against the rights of a nation. We haven't engaged in any undisclosed activities for him to caution us like this or to remind us that we need JCPOA 2.0. These actions are adherence to requests that are made of them. We have always requested the Director General to uphold the agency's credibility as an international independent body, unaffected by political agenda. And we stated in a March 2023 statement addressing the agency that the framework of our activities are based on the IAEA safeguards and the NPT. Considering the remaining items, we will interact and define a modality for the remaining issues and in-between matters between the two parties. These three clauses exist. There is currently no discrepancy or non-compliance between us, even regarding inspectors. The issue with the inspectors is an inherent right of any country and nation. According to Article 9, the agency must introduce inspectors to us. We evaluate the inspectors and express our opinion. This routinely happens. If we cancel a designee inspector or several inspectors, it's within the realm of inspections, and those inspectors hadn't even come to Iran in the first place. Then they portray it as if their inspectors were expelled. We didn't expel any inspectors. There haven't been any inspectors in Iran whom we expelled. There is a list, a roster, currently 125 inspectors, if I'm not mistaken, who are designees, meaning Iran has agreed for them to visit. However, not all of them necessarily come to Iran. So the excessive focus on Iran, the timely and untimely reports about Iran, is entirely contrary to norms. It's a double standard, and we strongly oppose this double standard. We have expressed our grievances to the agency and always expect the Director General to maintain that international credibility of the agency and not join the pressure group, the group consisting of three European countries that exert pressure on Iran, never align with them, and allow our relations to proceed naturally within the framework of the agreements and the NPT.
Mr. Islami, thank you very much for joining the program and for your time. Well, you heard about how the International Atomic Energy Agency has been adopting double standards with its approach to Iran and where it may be originating from. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. But that's not going to stop Iran's advancements in different fields of nuclear science and technology. That's going to be it for this edition of Face to Face.
Congratulations to everyone. Congratulations to everyone.
The last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Last Savior. I am Atar, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Islamic researcher, Brother Alevian. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in this series of the program, The Last Savior, we are mainly concerned with the topics related to Imam Al-As, Imam Al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. All right, Brother Alevian, in last episode, you talked about some of the missions which are given to the Sahabi or Ashab companions of Imam As at the time of reappearance or Zuhur. The second one was struggling against the deviations. Can you define the deviation for us? I mean, what do you mean exactly according to Imam Zaman, Imam Mahdi, Jalallah?
Yes, we said every revolution, every new movement, every uprising requires clarification on the goals and objectives.
Yes.
To tell the people that, for example, this revolution has these different characteristics, these different privileges, and these different points that makes it something different, so that people get satisfied and become willing to accept it. The same thing happens. We saw that even Imam Ali alayhi salam for some 25 years was out of the system, the governing system, that due to, lack of this knowledge among the people, that they deprived themselves from the presence of Imam.
Yes.
Let's not repeat the same deprivation. And Imam alayhi salam, he himself has this mission on his on the shoulder of his special companions, this 313 and the others who join him slowly, slowly. We said that in a hadith we have that when Imam comes, it's as if he brings a new religion.
Yes.
So there are lots of changes, innovations, bid'ahs, or bid'ah in the religion that even some people just got accustomed to those bid'ahs and innovations. So they need to get distant from this deviation and come and welcome whatever the pure Muhammadan Islam says.
Okay.
So the people...
even the interpretations of the ayahs and the ahadiths will be very much different.
Yes, because we see that nothing has been left at the time of Imam from Quran, just the
cover,
papers, just the cover of the Quran,
okay.
Right? So people recite Quran very beautifully, but they have no idea about what inside
what is the main batn or content.
Exactly. So we can sense it today, brother. I mean, without having these narrations from, I don't know, Elia Imams and infallible Imams, we can see that some people recite Quran very beautifully, but they are indifferent on what is going on in Islam world.
And when you ask about the meaning, the literal translation,
the literal translation
is given,
they are very clever in this literal translation of Quran.
Or so, acting on base upon the Quran is not seen or witnessed in our daily life of the people. This is what Imam al-Mahdi wants, isn't it?
Definitely.
Okay.
So different groups of people are the heads of these deviations, the owners of wealth, those capitalists and the elites of capitalism, and then owners of power, that is an Islamic and ostensibly Islamic governments.
Yes.
Those who claim just to become Islamic. We see that in some Islamic countries, people have no role in the management of the society.
Okay.
So where is the role of people in some, and let's say in most of Islamic countries?
Yes.
Can they have a say there? And also the owners of deception. The owners of deceptions, that is those people affiliated and worldly clerics, depending, or the men of knowledge, I mean Islamic knowledge, actually affiliated with governments and the corrupted systems.
So the so-called, you mean, biased people of the religion all across the world, you know, who are acting, for example, hand in hand with corrupt politicians,
very
isn't it?
True, exactly.
That's right.
So these are the owners or the leaders of these deviations.
Yes.
So in order to put them aside, it's not an easy task.
It's
it requires a person as knowledgeable as Ammar.
Yes.
He was a mujtahid. I mean, he had the knowledge to elaborate, like Malik al-Ashtarnakhai, to enlighten people with this knowledge and to tell them what is wrong
and
what is
wrong. And see, during all these years, all the thoughts and ideologies and philosophies are shaped, you know.
So this means
the people.
This person that is going to lead people on behalf of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he has to be a really knowledgeable person, not ordinary person.
Is the knowledge of the Imam given, for example, chest-to-chest to the companion or sahabi? Now he would be... He would be trustworthy, he would be authentic enough to answer all the queries and the questions of the people around.
Look, no one is independent of the blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through Imam on human beings. So whatever we have based on Ziyarat al-Jama'ah is the blessings that we receive through Imam. I mean, everyone. But if you mean that, is it something that came miraculously through Imam to them? No, I want to say it came through a natural order.
Yes.
But since we beg more at the door and the gate of Ahlul Bayt, they give us even more.
Okay.
Right?
That's right.
So the ones who have been close to Imam Ali al-Islam, let's say some decades ago, and they have been the students of Hawza at that time, we have seen that they have benefited from Imam a lot. And then they came to Iran, and alhamdulillah, their benefit from Imam was shown here and was given to the people here.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning the shadow, this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back, dear listeners of iRab English Radio. You are listening to the program, The Last Savior. I am Atan, the host of this program. Brother Alevian, struggling against deviations by the companions of Imam al-Mahdi, Jalallah. So, you were enumerating some of these deviations for us. You grouped some groups of the people who are deviated.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the others?
Actually, we have been talking about these three groups of the leaders of the deviators, yes, and deviations and distortions that had happened in Islamic Ummah and among the communities in the world. So Imam is going to fight with them, but the companions of Imam are needed to enlighten the people in order to inform them about these deviations and
yes,
to satisfy them and to give them a good perception on what these deviations are. But there is a beautiful hadith and narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that Imam says that the distress that Imam alayhi salam will face from the ignorant people of end time, that yes, is the Akhirah Zaman, that at the time of advent of Imam, is much more severe than all the distress that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi salam faced from the ignorant people of Jahiliyyah, mm-hmm, that is pre-Islamic era.
Yes.
So the person, the narrator, asked, why? How can it be, ya Imam? The Imam replied, the Prophet came to people who were worshipping rocks, right, and stones, wood, and caved wooden idols. But when our Imam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, rises up, people will argue against him using the book of God. Yes. You see? So this is more difficult. He stands in front of Imam with reasoning, referring to book of God.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who was torturing the Holy Prophet, he was not referring to the book
of
God.
He was not believing
He was not believing in Islam.
Okay.
So this person, so in order to stand
yes,
in front of such a person is yes, much more difficult than that.
So with the language of the Quran and Islam, he's going to oppose Imam.
Yeah,
Mas.
And
okay,
they try to interpret the verses of the Quran according
yes,
their own opinions in front of the Nas, who is Imam Ali Islam himself.
Uh-huh.
In front of the direct Quran, I mean the speaking Quran, the talking Quran himself.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so this is not easy.
Yes.
He also said, Imam alayhi salam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and continues and says that Imam will encounter difficulties in his battle against the opponents that the Prophet did not face. And he continues at the continuation of the same hadith. So we see that this is the special mission of the companions, the special companions of
yes,
Imam, that they are trying to work on the movements or the distorted
yes,
lines
yes,
of
correcting
movement.
Is better to say, or we can say reforming is better
reforming
to say.
Exactly,
yes,
and
yes,
standing in
yes,
front of wrong thoughts
approaches
and wrong
thoughts,
approaches in Islam and in Islam world.
And this is the sad news with all these rational movements and progresses that the human beings had all during all these 14 centuries. Now they are going to be worse than the people of Jahiliyyah.
Very true.
So people with knowledge, but they are jahil, you know. This is
so these people, these okay, companions of Imam, under the shadow of wilayah of Imam, mm-hmm, but not through a miraculous effect of Imam alayhi salam
yes,
on them. Under the shadow of wilayah of Imam, they try to train people,
yes,
to enlighten them, to give
okay,
them enough knowledge. It's interesting to know that the knowledge that they have, the amount of that knowledge they have is as good as the knowledge that Imam himself has.
Yes.
I mean, but it does not mean, since they have get connected
I
to Imam alayhi
mean,
salam,
yes,
they have got connected to the ocean
yes,
of ma'rifah and knowledge.
Yes.
They have
yes,
also some skills in management of
okay,
the societies.
Very
I mean,
good.
It has been said that every single of them is enough to control a whole country,
mm-hmm,
to lead a whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And when Imam actually sends them to different parts of the
okay,
world to actually manage the whole world,
mm-hmm,
Imam tells them, you won't face,
yes,
this is, I mean, my own wording, not the
yes,
exact wording of the hadith. Imam tells them, you are able to manage and to lead that area.
Yes.
But in case you face any problem, you
mm-hmm,
can just look at your palm of your hand and you will find the answer by me.
Okay.
You see? So it means that they are that equipped with knowledge, science,
yes,
and management skills.
Yes.
Such a revolution requires require such people. It is being said that Surah Al-Fatih, one of its interpretation is at the time of Imam, that people come, groups and groups of people come and join Islam and Islamic teachings.
Let's take our second break and then we'll continue our discussion. It was very kind of you.
You're welcome.